All right, good morning, everyone, and we welcome you to our study session this morning, September 23rd. First of all, I'd like to excuse the mayor, who is at the Conference of Mayors and also working on some issues with our light rail with the Federal Transit Administration, so good luck to him. And we also like to excuse Councilmember Richens, who is not with us. And with that, we will proceed with items on our agenda, first being to review the agenda for Monday night's meeting. And
you're just watching.
Anxious, are we? So the first item, do we have anyone, and notice that we have the new format on our agenda, which just a little bit different, so we need to make sure we look closely that we don't miss something. So do I have anything on page 2? How about page 3? 4? Go ahead, Dina.
I would like item 6A off the consent agenda.
Off the consent. Okay.
Thank you.
Any comments on it now, or you just want off consent to discuss them? Okay. Then moving on to page 5 and page 6. Go ahead, Scott.
Just curious why 3C, which is just a liquor license application, is off consent.
Yes, Vice Mayor, Councilmember Summers. In the application, they identified that they had a conviction for serving alcohol to a minor, June 25th of 2009. So we pulled it off of consent for that reason, just so the council could consider that.
Okay.
Is there a continuing history of that, or is that their only?
That is their only conviction, and best we could tell, the only violation that they had. And they have complied with all of the other requirements and paid all of their fees, so everything else is in order.
Okay. Have they put in place a plan to make sure that they don't sell to an underage minor again?
Yes. They were fined, and they also had to take and comply with the Arizona Liquor Board's recommendations for remedial training and so forth. So they've had to gone through that process.
And they have done all that?
They have done everything.
We will continue to monitor that if they don't.
Absolutely.
Vice Mayor, I'd recommend we put it back on consent.
Do we have a consensus? All right, let's go ahead and put it back on consent, and if anybody has a concern, we can pull it again.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Then we will go back to the study session agenda. The first item being a presentation to discuss and provide direction on the 2010-2011 property liability and aviation insurance. Go ahead now, Debbie.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Members of the council, we are here to seek direction from the council before we go out to bid on the 2011 insurance. With me, I have Mark Stedman, the deputy of the litigation team. We also have in the audience Barry Hegrenis, our claims manager, and Mr. Sherlock from Willis of Arizona, who is our insurance broker. We are going to talk about the three different types of insurance that we purchase annually for the city of Mesa. They are excess liability insurance, property insurance, and aviation insurance, which applies just to Falcon Field. And to give you just a general overview of the cost of our insurance per year, we have a chart here that shows, and these are all three types of insurance total. Over the years, we have had, a significant spike since 2001, and that spike kind of capped in November of 2005. Since then, it's been coming down slowly, but it is still a significant expense to the city of Mesa. Now, when we break it down to each individual type of insurance, excess liability insurance, that covers the city of Mesa for any claims of negligence against the city of Mesa or a city employee. It could be a police officer who's involved in a car accident while on patrol. It could be a pothole in the roadway, or it could just be a slip and fall in a city building. What we have for excess liability insurance, and this chart shows historically what type of coverage we've had and what the premiums have been for that insurance. Again, we saw the spike in 2005, and since that time it's been coming down slowly. The coverage limits, and it says including SIR, there's really two factors the council wants to look at and what we look at when we're purchasing insurance, and that is the coverage limits or the policy limits and the SIR, which is really just the deductible. How much does the city of Mesa pay before our insurance kicks in? Starting with the SIR or the deductible, Mesa is self-insured, so we pay the first $3 million on any claim. If there is a claim for a judgment or a settlement in excess of $3 million, that's when the insurance will pay the remainder or the difference there. We have gone back and forth between $2 and $3 million. We are currently at $3 million, and this is pretty comparable to other cities our size. Phoenix has a $5 million SIR, or sorry, deductible. Scottsdale and Chandler has a $2 million deductible. We're at $3 million, so we're right there in the ballpark there. So our broker is recommending that we stay at $3 million this year. With the coverage limits, the policy limits, we have increased over the years. So in 2003, we were at $28 million. That was probably too low for a city our size. We have been increasing that policy limit over the last several years. We're now at $38 million, and that includes the $3 million deductible. So we're really purchasing $35 million of insurance. This year, we are recommending that we seek bids both at $35 million and $45 million. We're probably still a little low. If you look at something, and this would obviously be a catastrophic loss, so this is one occurrence within, that would exceed $35 million. But if you look at what recently happened in California with the gas main break, something catastrophic like that, we would certainly be pushing the $35 million policy limit. So what we're recommending is that when we go out to bid, we will seek bids for both $35 million and $45 million, and we'll bring those bids back to the council, and the council can decide. This is really just a balancing the risk versus the cost of the additional insurance. So with regard to excess liability insurance, we're recommending a $3 million deductible, which is consistent with what we have, and a $35 and $45 million policy limit, and bring those back to council. Any questions for excess liability? No. The next type of insurance that we purchase is the property insurance, and that is just like your homeowner's insurance. It's to cover losses to city property. And again, this chart shows what we have had in the past and the cost of that insurance. We have currently a $300 million policy limit. And again, that would be a catastrophic loss, but it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility, and a $50,000 deductible. Our broker is recommending that we stay at $300 million policy limit. We are currently, and will in the next couple years, be doing an additional review of our assets to make sure that we have an accurate value for our assets. But right now, we think we're pretty much in the ballpark, and this will cover us sufficiently. So we are recommending that we stay at a $300 million policy limit. The deductible, we're at $50,000, which means if we have a loss to city property that's under $50,000, the city will absorb that. Anything in excess of $50,000, our insurance will pay. The broker is recommending that we keep both $50,000, but we also seek bids at $100,000. So we see, can we experience a cost savings by increasing our deductible? And is that worthwhile for us? So we would recommend bringing those back to the council. $300 million policy limit, $50,000 and $100,000 policy limit for property. Any questions on that?
No questions?
Vice Mayor.
Go ahead.
Debbie, how much property do we have out there worth, how many buildings do we have there worth $300 million? This is for our property, right?
This is for our property.
Okay. So how many buildings do we have to lose before we hit $300 million?
Barry would know better than I do.
I mean, are the hangars $300 million? That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Councilmember Summers and Vice Mayor and Council, we probably have in any one individual location, I'm not aware of one facility that's worth that amount, but a catastrophic event could take out you know, multiple buildings, for instance, the Mesa City Plaza and the Mesa Arts Center, unlikely, but if it took out both buildings at the same time, then we would be in that realm. And one occurrence, for instance, I just use flood as an example. If we had a massive flood that hit different parts of the city and took out multiple city assets, but not in one exact location, that would be one occurrence. And that one occurrence in total, you know, could take out over $300 million. But our total assets total for the city are approaching $1 billion. So we're insuring approximately one-third of our total asset value for any one occurrence. So I'm sorry if that was too wordy.
What's considered in the industry typical for a city to insure? What percentage of its assets? We're 30% of the assets. Is that industry? Is that typical of what most cities would do?
I would. It is typical. Depending on risk versus premium, cities will insure as low as maybe 20% of their assets. And there are some, actually some of our sister cities in the valley that actually insure 100% of their assets. But you are correct. Lower than 50% is an average as far as insuring all of your assets.
The type of insurance we have, fire, flood, mold, what are the parameters of this insurance that we're talking about?
Councilmember Finter and Vice Mayor and Council, the coverage is much like your homeowner's policy. There are exclusions. There are other things. There are various sublimits. For instance, if you have an earthquake, you're only covered for up to $1 million. Not likely here. Same thing with flood. And then we can choose to raise those sublimits within the policy. But it pretty much covers any type of risk or peril.
All right.
Okay, moving on to aviation.
Continue.
Stay here.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead? Okay, the last type of insurance that we purchase is aviation insurance, and this is for Falcon Field. Both property and liability excludes the airport, so we purchase a separate policy for the airport. And we do purchase, it's actually two different policies. One is to cover negligence that happens at the airport. Same with our excess liability with the City of Mesa. But what we purchase with regard to airport liability is a $50 million policy limit and a zero deductible. And we have a zero deductible for aviation because we went out last year and we sought different bids for what if we increased our policy limits. We found a negligible decrease in the premium, so it did not seem worthwhile for us to assume that risk with the deductible, along with the staff time in terms of monitoring these claims. Luckily, the airport has had a great loss history, so they get very good premium rates. So we are still
Lack of loss history.
Thank you. Sorry. So we are recommending that we stay at a $50 million coverage limit and a zero deductible for the liability on the airport. With regard to the aircraft liability, both property and liability that might happen because of that, this is the police aircraft, whether it's the helicopter or the airplanes that the police department has at Falcon Field. We have a $50 million policy limit for liability caused by that aircraft. That could be a negligence in landing or taking off, whatever might happen with regard to that aircraft, and a zero deductible. And with regard to the property damage to the aircrafts, we recommend that we insure the stated value for the aircraft, so we'll get the value of the aircraft reimbursed, and the deductible depends on whether the aircraft is in motion or not in motion. $25,000 for in motion accident and $1,000 not in motion. That could be storm damage, or a storm comes in and it damages the aircraft. We would only have a $1,000 deductible, and we're recommending that we stay at that.
Dennis has a question for you.
Just a question with regard to the city's aircraft, the various types that we have at Falcon Field. Can you tell us exactly how many aircraft we have at this time and what the nature of them are between planes and helicopters?
Yes. Councilmember Cavanaugh, Vice Mayor and Council, the aircraft that we currently have, we have five aircraft. That would be three police air support helicopters, and then we have two fixed-wing aircraft, and those are the ones that would be insured under this policy.
As I recall, is one of the fixed-wing aircraft a recent purchase by the city?
That is correct.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Vice Mayor.
Okay, unless there's any other questions, we will go forward and go out to bid with those parameters. We expect that we'll come back probably in early November with the bids for council action.
Okay. Scott?
I was just looking at the premiums, Debbie, and from, of course, we're increasing our policy limit this year to $300 million from $2 million. So that's going to, that correlates to an increase in the premium. In 05, 06, 06, 07, we increased from $165 million on the limit to $200, but there was a drop in the premiums from $347 to $254. And then again, the following year, we kept 06, 07, 07, 08, $200 million. The policy limits were the same. The deductible was the same. And another $54,000 reduction in the policy limit. So What happened in those years, particularly 5 to 7, we increased the policy limits and had a substantial cut in the premiums?
It was just the market. We increased our policy limits because we thought we could first purchase for the same price, we could purchase more insurance, and our recommendation was to increase our policy limits. But it was really just the market. We have had a very favorable loss history with regard to property. In the past nine years, we've only had one claim on our property insurance, and that was damage to a fire truck that occurred. So in terms of the city of Mesa, our loss history has kept a very favorable cost in terms of our premiums, but this was the market. And I think it was a buildup from 2001, and then I'm not sure, I don't remember which year Katrina happened, but that was an impact to the market as well. And now it is beginning to, it went back up. We're hoping it doesn't go up any further. But if you remember last year, even our broker said the market is getting a little tighter, which means we weren't going to see probably significant savings. And that was because of the financial market that in the past 2 years. But Councilmember, let me just correct. We are currently at $300 million for property policy limits. So we're just recommending that we stay at the same level.
Right. That's 910. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Then direction is to proceed with.
Thank you.
Put it up to bid. Thank you. Next on our agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed nuisance code changes. Tammy, come on up.
This is a nuisance.
Vice Mayor, Council Members, good morning. Okay. First thing I wanted to let you know is that you all have a new packet in front of you. They represent a few of the changes from some conversations with Councilmember Richens earlier in the week. So we've also had some other conversations, but they're not part of what's being presented to you right now. When code compliance came over to Neighborhood and Community Services about a year and a half ago, the first thing we did is take a look at the ordinance. Did the language in the ordinance meet the intent of what we were trying to do? So we thought we'd make some changes. There was three criteria under which we did this: to strengthen the code for our enforcement efforts, to clarify the language, to simplify the language, and to add any new sections. To determine what needed to be added or what we were going to change, we reviewed the civil hearing office outcomes from the hearings to determine if we've lost any cases, under what conditions did we lose them? Was it the language of the code that we lost, or was it our preparation? But if it was the code, how could we strengthen the code? We also took some recommendations from the action team, citizens, and council members. We started with the purpose statements. There were purpose statements already in the code, but we modified them, strengthened them, so that it's really clear that the nuisance code is a maintenance code. It is not a regulatory code like, say, the zoning code, where you find out what you can have or can't have or what it has to look like. It's a code that says if you have it, you must maintain it. We also added a purpose statement for the residential rental interior residential rental program that was approved by council last year. We made some changes to the definition sections. What you see in the PowerPoint as noted as new is new to the nuisance code, but not new to the city code. Those are a lot of definitions that are found in other parts of the city code, but we brought them into here for ease of use. We did add the word damage to blight so that we could deal with some burned out structures. We added the word object to graffiti so that we could deal with anything that had graffiti, not just a structure or a building. The biggest change we made in the definition sections was under responsible party. We had lost cases before because most of our code said owner or tenant. So if we were dealing with a property management agent or a real estate agent, they just came in and said, I'm not the responsible party. So we have expanded that so it has it covers anybody who should have something to do with that property. We made changes to slum property just to match the state code, and we removed all references to animals because that was done under your livestock ordinance and put somewhere else in the code not too long ago. Changes made, this was probably one of our larger changes, and this is where we had some discussion at the community and neighborhood services. Did I say that backwards or did I say that right? First thing, we added the word unregistered vehicle to this section. It used to say inoperable and abandoned. Now it says all three. There was a lot of confusion that if a vehicle did not have a current tag, it was inoperable. Not necessarily true. That was just one of the criteria you could use. So we just made it clear and add unregistered to it. We also said that if you just covering your vehicle with a car cover does not mean it's now operable. And then the discussion took part in whether or not we limit how many vehicles can be on a property. So as part of the discussion, two alternatives came out of that. Limiting it to two vehicles if the property is under 35,000 square feet and up to four vehicles if it's over 35,000 square feet. Part of the discussion was if you are a person who as a hobby redoes cars, typically you have two cars with every one you're redoing, the car you're building and your parts car. So if you have a large lot and this is your hobby, is it reasonable to have up to four? The other option was limiting it to two regardless of your lot size. We did do some benchmarking with some other communities. Chandler and Tempe limit them regardless of the lot size. Scottsdale requires everything be enclosed, and Gilbert was probably the least restrictive in that they just require it be behind a fence, but they don't even require the fence be solid. So the question would be, does the city want to limit the number of inoperable and unregistered vehicles on a lot? And if so, should that be regulated by lot size, or do you want to require everything be kept indoors? Now, do you want to discuss this now, or you want to at the end?
How many discussion items will we have?
There will be two points where we talk.
Then let's get through the presentation, then we'll have discussion.
Okay. Other changes we made were to be able to enforce stagnant bodies of waters and not just pools. A lot of times we have retention basins or other types of body of waters that have become stagnant, so this will give us some more enforcement leverage. Again, the graffiti change so that we can get anything on a property. K is the other part that we made some substantial changes to. We've added the word damage, so again, we can deal with burned properties. We also added visible from any right-of-way and not just adjacent right-of-way. So for instance, if you are on a street behind a house and there's a property between the street and the house, if you can still see that they have not maintained their property, then we would still be able to deal with them under this code. We also added a statement clarifying what this section really is about. In the past, people have thought that it regulated the design of a building or the color of a building. All it's doing is saying, if you have it, you must maintain it in the condition in which it was approved. M, we are now going to hold the business owner displayed on bandit signs as a responsible party, as opposed to just the person who installed it in the middle of the night. We're adding requirements to deal with partially constructed buildings. That has been a problem with the economy, people just sort of stopping construction. So we can work with them now to either finish it or remove it, or at least the exterior portion of it. And we added a section for illegal dumping, which is a state requirement for us. Here's the other discussion item that came up from the committee meeting is, in the zoning code, they regulate parking of RVs. In the nuisance code, we regulate parking of watercraft and utility trailers. And in the past, they've always kind of mirrored each other. But there were some concerns about the way the code reads is if the vehicle is over 6 foot high, then it has to be located behind a 6 foot high fence. And there was some concerns about how is that 6 foot height measured? To the highest point of a boat, to the wakeboard, to the windshield, you know, at what point is that 6 feet? So we said we would benchmark other communities. What we found is none of the other communities regulate the screen, it being located behind a fence based on the height of the vehicle. Scottsdale requires everything be behind a fence. Chandler and Tempe, they don't require that they be behind fences, but they do require they're on the side or rear of the yard. All of them required that they not be located in the front yard. A couple options, and this one came from Councilmember Richards, is to allow the boat or utility trailer to be parked on the side of the property or rear at a point that's equal to the furthest most point of the home, and that includes overhangs. So there's two options, including overhangs or excluding overhangs. And here's kind of a diagram of what you would get out of that. If you included overhangs, porches, those kind of things, your boat could be slightly in front of your main portion of your home. If you exclude overhangs, it would have to be tucked more into the side. Second option would be simply add a definition for height. How are we going to measure that? And just say it would be to the highest point, regardless, or excluding antennas, though. So again, here would be discussion items on, do you want to limit how or what vehicles need to be screened based on their height, or do you just place everything behind the wall? And again, this is not RVs. This is just boats and utility trailers, things of those nature. In V, V had two sections that didn't seem to really go together. One was about the structural stability of something, and the other one talked about maintenance of safe yards. So we split them out, but we did add maintenance of private streets and drives to the second part of it. The changes we made to the enforcement section is we added some flexibility for the civil hearing officer. So code compliance is about compliance. It's not about fines and fees. So this will allow the hearing officer to reduce a fine the amount that it costs somebody to abate the problem, if that seems reasonable in that situation. It's not across the board. It's part of what he would examine as the hearing, he or she. The second part was change habitual offender to 36 months from 24. What this would do, for instance, if we are out there and every year we have to go have them cut their weeds, if we do only two citations in 24 months, then we can't process them as a habitual offender. If we extend that out to 3 years, now if we go out there every year to tell them to cut their weeds, now we can process as a habitual offender. And then there's some changes to the court section that would also allow a judge to reduce the fine if it is brought into compliance within a certain time period. So we can go back to the discussion items at this point, if you'd like.
Boats and vehicles.
Let's see if I can do this.
I had a couple of minor points before we get into the...
Go ahead, Alex.
Just a couple of minor points before we get into the two... big discussion items. Under definition of commercial vehicle, I know we've had a challenge in District 2 with regard to a auto towing repo business operating out of a residential neighborhood. One of the challenges was the tow trucks that they use now are kind of a modified pickup, just a normal pickup with an apparatus in back that kind of it would be nice to see some sort of maybe a little more in-depth definition. I think right now you're proposing 13,000-pound type of, if I read that correctly, commercial vehicle definition. I don't know if there's maybe it's something that goes into a little bit more detail with regard to one of those challenges.
Gordon is actually working on the change in the zoning code, and then we're duplicating it. But he did add, him and I did talk about that, and he was adding something along the lines of used for a business, so that it says this is a size requirement or used as a business.
Oh, perfect.
So we will be duplicating what he's writing in the zoning ordinance.
Excellent. Vice Mayor, just right. Another couple of minutes. With regard to a responsible party, I think that's going to raise quite some debate in the community. I think getting ahead of that and outreach to the Southwest Realtors Association, maybe some education allows them to educate their folks on what's going to be expected now from the city. I think it's a good move. Just maybe some opportunity to, reach out to folks that are responsible now for these things and may not realize it. So the first indication they get isn't, a citation, but they've had due process. And then on one other minor point, if I could, Vice Mayor, was, I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. And it's a very good point, because it's important that we get ahead of the game as far as notifying people of what the changes are and how that's going to affect them. And by so doing, we'll encourage them to follow more closely those whom they hire to put their signs out and to monitor that closely.
I will say that with the foreclosures, we have built up some really good relationships with the banking industry. We have great contacts, and we'll get a notice out to all of them. But we kind of work with them, because once they take it over, they're the owner. And so we've been working with them, and they've been very responsive to
them. Excellent.
All right, good. Dennis?
With respect to the discussion item, at least on the first one, on the inoperable vehicles, this came from complaints in my district. And my feeling is I think we should approach it in terms of which option is easiest for the public to understand, which option is easiest for staff to administer, so that there's no misunderstanding or confusion, which is why my recommendation to staff was to take the approach in Chandler and Tempe and simply limit it to two inoperable or unregistered vehicles. I think the requirement is clear for both the public and for the staff. And we're consistent with neighboring communities, which both have large lots and smaller lots. And I'm not aware of any difficulties or challenges raised in enforcement in those communities by having it that simple. That would be my position on the issue. Thank you, Vice Mayor.
Go ahead, Dana.
The reason we chatted and recommended more vehicles on bigger lots is the thought process was working along the lines of the livestock ordinance. The larger the lot, the more carrying capacity it has. So the idea was, if you have the 1 acre lot in Mesa, you have the space, you can go ahead, they're screened to actually have more vehicles than in a smaller lot. Because a smaller lot, carrying capacity isn't there to have the whole backyard covered with cars. But in a larger lot, you actually do. So that was the idea behind going to the four vehicles. It along the same lines of the livestock ordinance. So I like this. I like the way it's written now. I think it's a good job. Thank you.
Okay, Scott.
I think that everybody should be allowed to enjoy their hobby, because quite frankly, the hobby of restoring antique cars, one is fascinating to me. Completely non-mechanical. That's why I'm a fireman. I can only break things. But we use that too downtown. We're not breaking things downtown, but the vehicles come downtown. They have the night outs, and it's quite fun to walk up and down and see what talented people are able to do. But also there has to be a certain respect to your neighbors. You don't get to operate a junkyard in your backyard. I was in, you'll like this story, I was in Cancun with my wife on honeymoon, and they ran their fire department. They had one truck that worked, and they had three trucks out front that they were pulling off of, and it looked like a junkyard. And I hope they're a lot safer now for anybody going to Cancun soon, but I just because you have a bigger lot, I don't know that you're going to be working on more than one vehicle, and I understand having one vehicle that you're taking parts off of. But we shouldn't be allowing people to operate junkyards in their backyard, even if it's their hobby. Quite frankly, most of the people I know do their work in their garage. They either have an expanded garage or they put a utility building out back fully equipped and heaters and all that, and they work on it there. If you want to have two or three cars in a garage, with for parts out of sight, out of mind, and work there, stack them to the ceiling for all I care. But I don't think you should be turning your backyard into a junk heap, because that impacts your neighbors. I actually prefer Scottsdale's ordinance to some extent, where these things have to be out of sight, whether you do this in your own home, in your garage, or out and back into a shed. I think it allows you to do your hobby, but it's a respect for the neighborhood, and it just builds a better mesa, because, you know, appearances make a big difference in a community when you come into it. When you see a nice, clean, neat, well-organized community, you want to live there, you want to invest there. That's where you want to open your business. When you see what looks to be chain link fences and junkyards and back, you don't want to be there. So, I would err on the side of being a little more stringent. I think things Chandler's is acceptable. Chandler Tempe is acceptable. But, you know, Scottsdale's a nice community, too. And I think that would be the one that I'd prefer to look at.
Okay. Alex, how do you weigh in on this?
Thank you, Mayor. Good Vice Mayor. I would probably take that first option, limit of two. Would hope that they are screened or behind a fence. On the larger lots, up to four. Again, I don't want to see it, but you know. And then I don't think we should require them to be enclosed. But from the front, I'd rather not see it and have it. You've got four. My son just, you know, it was interesting. My son has been pushing on Craigslist, wants to have a little fixer-upper project. I've been dragging my feet on purpose to. Figure, but well, no, he's got one. But you know, taking and fixing up a neat old vehicle, you know, it's a great. I think that could be, but I don't think it should be anywhere where anybody else has to experience it. You know, back, you know, screened. Love to have you know, many of the things Councilmember Summers said. Solid, clean community. And I love somewhere in here you used reasonable. Really appreciate reasonable. So whatever we figure out that to be. So. If I've jumped around enough, I would prefer the first of the two options, not requiring coverage, but definitely screened and away from anybody else having to experience that. So.
I should probably point out a couple of things. The nuisance code does not have grandfathered rights. So whatever change we make will apply across the city. So if, for instance, and we have added the word unregistered. So for instance, let's say you have a child that goes to the military. You have no reason to register their vehicle right now. It's not going to be used for the next year or something. It's not inoperable. It doesn't look bad. This is going to regulate where that can be placed on the property and how many you can have. So it's not just junk vehicles. We've added the word unregulated or unregistered to this. And there are no grandfathered rights here. So I just wanted to throw that out so you can understand the full picture.
And everything is screened. We're not suggesting cars anywhere else. You cannot see these from the right of way. Or how's the wording on that exactly?
Currently,
yes. I mean, what's recommended?
Yeah, everything would be screened. But currently, you can park a operable but unregistered vehicle on the side of your property and not have that be behind a 6-foot fence. This is this is putting everything together and saying whether it's inoperable or unregistered. you know, if you're going to store it, it should be back.
Great. Thank you.
All right. I do have a problem with the unregistered in that in a lot of situations they may not have a place to park on the side or in back, but yet they might have a two-car carport. Maybe it's elderly person whose son or daughter went to the military or something, and they have a car that they don't want to register, and it's just parked in the carport. Mm-hmm. And what this will do is say you cannot park a car, even though it may look good and everything. If it's not currently registered, it's illegal. I have a discomfort level with that. As long as it's reasonably kept and not building up the cobwebs, that they keep it all clean and nice, that should not be included in inoperable cars, in my perception, my perspective. So I'm having a problem lumping that particular aspect together.
Okay.
As far as the other cars that are inoperable that people want to work on and stuff, I would rather keep it limited to two and keep it screened not just from the street but from all sides for all neighbors, that they don't have to sit and look at it. There needs to be a minimum 6-foot fence from all angles for them to screen that.
If we remove the word unregistered from this section, it is still covered under Section T that says if you don't have a current plate, it cannot be in your front yard setback, but it can be on your sides and in your carport. So we still would have some regulations to deal with not letting unlicensed cars be in the front yard setback.
That makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah.
Dina?
Why couldn't we just add the word carport? Because that's kind of what you're saying. If it's in your carport, it would be okay. Because you still don't want to see unregistered cars parked on someone's side yard for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand. I mean, a carport's like your garage. So I understand that. But I'm not happy with it being able to be on the side yard. So can we specify that?
We could clearly state.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the carport.
We can do whatever we want.
No, I mean, would that make it, would that work with you? You know, your carport example, excellent, but wouldn't be happy with it in the side yard, but I'm okay with it in a carport. Like I said, I mean, it's your part of your house kind of carport.
To have it sit on a side yard for extended time is going to get the cobwebs.
It's not the same as being in a carport to me. I mean, a carport's contained part of your house, but the side of your yard is more like becoming junky.
We could write something to that effect.
I would agree. I would favor adding the carport option. I mean, we have had difficulties. I can point to a house, Marlboro Mesa, right next to the city park where the car is unregistered and it has cobwebs. It has not moved in 2 years. Of course, the house also has other issues, but it's highly visible, and that's clearly one that we've been frustrated because we haven't been able to site that particular location. And every time we have a community event there, many people mention it to me and why don't we have the tools to deal with it, and I think this would help. But I also understand what Vice Mayor Jones is saying about the option with the carport, and I agree with Councilmember Higgins.
Scott?
Is there a way to put a time limit on this where you could keep that vehicle for 4 years or 2 years and actually be able to enforce it?
It would be difficult to enforce because it would be similar to some of our other things like sign. In the sign code, there's time limits on how do you determine an abandoned sign. You have to open a case and then wait. So it has to remain open for the next couple of years until you. So it would be, and you don't really know what happened in between. You don't know if it was moved, if it was. So it would be difficult to enforce with a time limit.
The problem I see is that, well, my son went into the military, which is a perfectly good excuse. And then he went, got out of the military, got another job, and next thing you know, we're on the next episode of American Pickers, where the car's been sitting out there for the last 14, 15, 20 years, and has suddenly become an antique. And that's not really the intent of this council. It's to add some flexibility to folks who have a reason for parking an unregistered vehicle there for a period of time. But I think once you start pushing past 2 years, you know, if my son were or my daughter were to join the military, I would expect that once they've had their base assignment, they'd be calling me to drive their vehicle, unless they were in Europe. They'd be calling me to pick up their vehicle. and they're going to want to register their vehicle and utilize it on the military base in their assignment in the States. So I don't think a military vehicle is going to be parked very long in a front yard. The older folks may have it parked for maybe a year or two before they finally realize that they're going to give it up and try mass transit as long as it's not in East Mesa.
That's for another day. So I just wonder if we can add a time frame into this and maybe look at how we setting up a database. And I know that's not, I know that you're not excited about that opportunity. But the idea of having somebody say that their child went to the military and then 12 years later, the car still sits there is going to be an issue.
We certainly could do that.
Well, and also curiosity in the verbiage of a car sitting in a carport. I mean, if it's building cobwebs on it and has a layer of dust, there's a problem. How do we address that as far as appearances? I mean, if it, I don't care if it's registered as long as it doesn't look like it's been sitting there and going to stay there forever.
The definition of abandoned or inoperable vehicle on your packet, it starts to talk about deflated tires on blocks. It's stripped. So it lists some things that we will use to determine whether it's inoperable. Some codes do say cobwebs and things like that. We have kind of stayed away from that because if that's the only thing we're out there, you got cobwebs, they brush them away. You're kind of have to close, you're done. So we've kind of focused on things that, you know, they have to fix the car.
Yeah, that's the inoperable portion.
Right.
I'm looking back at the unregistered.
If it's current code, if it's unregistered and parked in a parked carport or, like I said, on the side of the house, it's fine. It's not, there's not a violation at all. So we certainly could add language if the comfort level is to keep unregistered in that section A, we could add language that this doesn't apply to vehicles in legal parking spots.
Okay, well, my question arises because I know that in the past, and I don't remember how many years ago it was, where I had complaints where they had received citations for a parked car in a carport that the tags were expired. And because it had been sitting there for an extended time and it had a couple of cobwebs, they were cited and said, you can't park it here. And so that's where my concern comes. If it's an operable car, probably looks better than a lot of other cars in carports, but they were cited because they were expired tags. So I just want to make sure that we have flexibility for reasonableness.
We certainly can write the fact that they could stay there and that would be a legal parking spot. And as part of all this change, I will be doing training with all of the officers so that we're all on the same page and it's all being consistently enforced. And the reasonableness, you know, most of our officers are very good about taking a look at, you know, is it operable, is it not, is it just need to be cleaned up, those type of things.
Okay, so what you're looking for is direction now, and from what I heard, I think the majority was leaning towards the option of limiting two be
behind,
screened.
Behind a fence can't be seen from the front yard.
Dina?
Well, we are missing two other council members, so I don't know if that's...
Well, if you have four, it doesn't matter.
So this can't come... I know that might be the case, but sure. We can still... Is this direction? We're not voting on this at any other council meeting?
Yeah, this is direction, and then what we will come back is we will write the ordinance and bring the ordinance
to you.
Just
come back with a revised code to review. This is just direction on how to continue writing.
Yes.
Wonderful.
All right. Go ahead.
Two very quick observations. Wanted to express my appreciation on the enforcement approach. Excuse me, in the 2 years that I've been here, all of us have had the opportunity for situations that arise where it's the grandma or someone with failing health that has difficult circumstances. Code enforcement, neighborhood services has done a wonderful job of outreach, service projects, it isn't about hammering the person that's under difficult circumstances. It's about getting the job done and helping. So really appreciate that approach that's been taken. And the other is realizing that your area is greatly understaffed, and realize that that causes a challenge in morale in other areas. We're asking a lot of times to do more with much, much less. So if I'm sure I speak for others to say we appreciate the work and we're aware of it, but ask them to keep up the good work in doing it. So, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. So, Tammy, just tell me what you glean from our comments, what direction you're headed on this. Just
that we want to keep the word unregistered in there, but we do want to put some clarification that if it's an illegal parking spot, that it is acceptable, and that we're going to limit it to two unregistered or inoperable vehicles on any lot, but they have to be behind the front yard setback, and if they're inoperable, screened.
Okay.
Did I hit it?
Wait, go ahead.
No, because you just said if they're inoperable, screened, which would imply to me I could park my operable car in my side yard, which I can't do.
Okay, so you just want the unregistered only in like a carport, all other ones to be screened. Or
wow,
illegal
say
parking
that again.
Spot. So the unregistered ones would only be permitted in a designated parking spot. Everything else, unregistered or inoperable, has to be screened.
Yes. Isn't that what we basically, okay. I thought everything had to be screened unless
okay.
it was in a carport. Or
that,
yeah.
If it's not in a designated typical parking space, I think it should be screened.
Right. Okay. We'll write
all
something
right.
up to that effect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now to traders and boats. And, the question being, where should they be placed? What should the setback be as far as from the point of the vehicle? And I will throw out my thoughts first, as I think it, if you're going to park on a side yard, it should not proceed past the closest point that it's parked at. It should be at that point. Meaning if you have the frontage of your house and you have one part that pops out further,
yeah.
I don't want a vehicle off to the side or a boat or something that can come out to that point of the part
if it's not
the closest point to it.
So number two?
That would be more for me.
I concur. Number two.
This one?
Yes.
Okay.
I
don't think should protrude past the closest point of the building.
And how do you feel about the 6-foot height limit? If it's over 6 foot, it has to be behind a block wall. Do you feel it being on the side and rear of the properties is good enough screening in of itself, or?
Well, what would come into play is what's around it and how is it taken care of.
Okay.
If you start growing weeds or if you start collecting things around it, if it's the only thing there, that's one thing. But if it starts collecting a lot of items around it, it becomes a trashy view. But I want to get feedback from the rest of you.
Yeah.
Dina?
I'm okay with it protruding above a 6-foot fence. You know, Councilmember Richens was concerned with the mast or the antennas or that. But if it's behind a 6-foot fence, in option B of this one, which means it's behind the front setback of your house, behind a 6-foot fence, I don't see a problem with it poking up above it, because then we kind of follow along the RV thing, which we allow huge 20-foot RVs to be parked on the side of your house as long as it's behind a 6-foot fence and behind the front setback of your house. So,
well, currently it doesn't have to be behind a 6-foot fence if the vehicle's under 6 foot in height.
Okay.
So are you still comfortable with keeping that language and then just defining how we measure height? Or are you comfortable getting rid of the height thing altogether? And again, I want to note that this does not have grandfathered rights. So across Mesa, people have boats and utility trailers on the side of their homes that are under 6 feet in height and not behind 6-foot fences and are legally parked, that this would make illegally if we took that thing away and said everything had to be behind 6-foot fences. So it's either we define height or we kind of eliminate it together, or?
I could finish up with that same comment where without Councilmember Richens being here, this kind of follows the same line of the car parked mm-hmm. in the side yard where it's something parked there that mm-hmm. should be screened.
Okay.
So did you mention on how other cities do this?
Yes.
I,
We did a survey. None of the other cities require screening based on the vehicle height. Scottsdale's the only one that requires everything be behind a 6-foot fence. Chandler, Tempe, they allow them on the sides and rears, but they don't necessarily require them behind a 6-foot fence.
I think it was the other, Tempe requires
or
fully screened. Yeah,
oh,
that's okay.
I'm sorry, Tempe was fully screened.
And you, I mean, based on your experience of driving around the city, if we went with the Tempe option, would there be a huge problem?
We would have a lot of people who were legally parked before that would not be now.
But then the masonry trade in Mesa would be very busy putting up fences, right? I mean, economic development, wherever we can find it, it's...
I'm just trying to give you all the info.
You've always wanted to be quoted in
Go
the paper.
Ahead, Alex.
Now you will. Now I'm pretty much sure you will be.
I would support the vice mayor's position. If you have an operable boat and you take it in and out regularly, it's back, be at least even with the house. But if it becomes a storage yard for, and I did say operable, an inoperable boat that's got a lot of junk piled around it and weeds, then it probably should be in the screen. So I don't know if operability is a good way to look at it. But that would be my reasonable look at things. If you got a big pile of junk, you got to screen it. If you have an operable boat that you take in and out regularly and use, it seems reasonable that it wouldn't be the eyesore, the challenge to the neighborhoods kind of thing. So.
And not just a boat, but utility trailers,
yes. Oh, yeah.
those types of things. Scott?
I also concur with the vice mayor's comments. I think what we're looking at is how neat, how well do you maintain your front yard? The position of the boat is going to be important. It's akin to what we're looking at in our zoning code with trying not to make neighborhoods with nothing but garage doors in front, because we want to have the aesthetic of the neighborhoods. This is much the same. As long as it's pushed back beyond the plane of the building, that there's no debris or weeds building up around it, it's maybe a legal parking lot, just as a motor vehicle has to park on a legal pad or improved surface, then I would be fine with it being not behind a fence. HOAs can change that if they want to.
Okay, what about above 6 feet? They need to go back, or you're not worried about it? Okay. So the key is going to be the operability and the presentation of and the surface that it's on. You can't just put it on dirt on the side.
Yeah,
of the house.
No, that's other parts of the codes. It always has to be in an improved surface. That's other parts of the code.
Okay, Dina?
And there is a definition of a utility trailer.
We
just
can.
So I don't park the 40-foot box trailer and say, oh, it's my utility trailer.
We will put one together if there isn't one.
And there is, though. I mean, I'm just
sure
asking kind of a question.
There is somewhere, but we will make sure it gets included.
Because we're talking one of those little, just low, what you would think would be a utility trailer, but just to make sure someone doesn't, and then parks their 40-foot RV and calls it a utility trailer kind of thing.
Yeah, there's definitely definitions on what is an RV versus things like that. So.
Thank you.
Okay, so you got your direction.
I did. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Oh, God, that was hard.
Then our next presentation will be item 2B here, presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed, extraordinary homes programs.
You have me again.
Is that you?
That's me again. Where is it? Let me see.
You're just in the hot
seat. I am. Where
you can take
at?
Pictures of my house. Stalking me.
I didn't see anything this week.
Not until I get that landscaping done. I'll call it.
Extraordinary home. Oh, that's
that
the
old. Right,
what's up?
You keep saying to come to my house to see my grass.
How do you know I haven't been there?
You have grass?
Here comes Cal.
Really? You put that where the.
While you're getting ready to talk about that, I just want to make one clarification then. When we talked about the boats and stuff, that was the overhang I'm not as concerned about is just don't go beyond the closest plane that it's parked to.
The building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the front setback.
Which, well.
Right.
Yes.
Go back to the pictures.
Yeah, by definition, it's the front setback.
By definition, that it doesn't go beyond the plane of that point. Right.
That it's directly adjacent to.
The,
okay.
That closest plane, yes.
Okay.
And we are talking plane, not overhang.
Yeah. Not overhang as much as just the plane of the building.
Well, Vice Mayor.
Yes.
Out of curiosity, a thought just occurred to me. Do we want to connect these two? Because if you have a boat and then two cars and scooter, and now all of a sudden, while you may only have two cars and a boat, and they start adding up into a parking lot.
It goes back to your designated parking spaces of what's legal, of what you can park.
I'm just concerned that they're different things. Well, I don't have three cars. I got a boat, a scooter, two of this, one of that. I got two of every type of animal on this arc, and. Mm-hmm. And then it starts looking like a barn, or in this case, a parking lot. I'm a little concerned that maybe we ought to look at the cumulative effect of all of these vehicles, watercraft, aircraft, short-range missiles, whatever they're storing.
I'll benchmark some of the other communities and see how they deal with the effect of all of
the cumulative effect.
Thank you.
Now let's proceed with the Extraordinary Home Program.
Don't give me time to think.
Tell
me
when you want to. Okay. I can do that.
That's very dangerous. You've got the mic.
Okay. This program is just what we just wanted to kind of update you on a new program that we're getting ready to launch. This was the idea of one of our code officers. And basically, it's a program where we can acknowledge the reinvestment that people put back into their home. What we would do is the winners would be, we would look at them quarterly, and the winners would be recognized by the council members in some kind of public forum. And then at the end of the year, a grand prize winner could be recognized as part of the Mesa, Building a Better Mesa program that the mayor is launching. Basically, we would put a committee together of both internal and external folks, and they would meet quarterly. We would review all of the nominated homes. All nominated homes would at least get a certificate, and then the winner of that quarter, or winners, would get a laminated poster to put in their yard for 30 days. We put them on the web. We can put them on Channel 11. We can do all kinds of promotion to show what they have done in their community. We will be focusing on those homes that exceed their neighborhood design standards. So it wouldn't just be a great-looking home and a great-looking subdivision. For the most part, these are going to be these neighborhoods that are 50, 60, 70 years old, and they have completely re-beautified their home. It's an opportunity, too, for the code officers to be out there in a positive light. They're in the neighborhood anyways. You're driving by, you see it, you take a photo. But anybody could nominate the home. You could nominate your neighbor. And we're hoping that this becomes a catalyst so that other people start to do this. We feel that it marries really nicely with the Quality of Life Initiative and the mayor's Building a Better Mesa. And then here's just a couple examples of the types of homes we're looking at. This home is like south of Broadway and like between Mesa Drive and Country Club. It's in a neighborhood that the average home is about 60 years old. And you can see what they've done to this home is just incredible. So this is one example. And then this would be, I know this is dark on there, but this is another example. Again, this is in that same general area. So it was just an opportunity for us to tell you one of the programs that we're going to launch. We did present this to the Community and Neighborhood Services. Did I say that right? I always get that backwards. Meeting. So we're excited about this. Again, it was the idea of one of our code officers, and we hope to get it up and running here very soon.
All right. Comments? Scott?
I think this is absolutely wonderful. It's the potential to utilize this to help build and work with neighborhoods when you pair it with things like a Building Strong Neighborhoods program and utilizing a house in there as an example when we do the when we launch that BSN program in some of these neighborhoods to be able to use that house as an exemplar for the rest of the neighborhood and then and build up from there is fantastic. What you may want to consider is looking at awarding a number of winners per quarter based on the type of house. Okay. So maybe, maybe for example, you have ordinary single-family home, duplex, mobile homes would be a good one because there's some really some people do some nice work cleaning up their mobile home parks, even apartments, and later on look at freestanding small business might be something that you might want to do later on depending on how this works.
Actually, we are hoping to expand it to commercial. That was one of the comments from Council Member Richens as well. So we thought we'd get it up and running and get it kind of.
Richens said that? Oh,
and then we can kind of add in the other ones and launch a really nice program.
I think if you couple this with some of our other programs and then put the winners on, you know, we'll run Channel 11 with City Media and do a few of those on there, I think, and use that as a bragging point. I think that's what's going to help build this up over time. It'd be good idea. Good idea. Thank you, Mayor.
All right.
Vice Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Next, we have the acknowledgement of
second
and receipt of minutes. Well, we have the Museum and Cultural Advisory Board. We have Economic Development Advisory Board, Community and Neighborhood Services meeting, Public Safety Committee meeting, Audit and Finance Committee meeting. We have a lot of various boards and committees that we have to have the meetings and officially approve them. And so we have a motion from Councilmember Summers.
Second.
A second from Councilmember Finter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much. Next is reports on meetings or conferences attended. Do we have any to go over, Alex?
We had our Building Strong Neighborhoods in the area of 24th Street and south of Lindsay between, in that general area. Wonderful attendance. We had great participation by city staff and other folks that provide services in the community. Just a really positive, a lot of neighbors willing to get out. There's been extraordinary investment by the city in that area, refurbishing parks, the streets, a lot of great efforts. So just a big believer in that program and getting folks motivated to participate. So thank you, Vice Mayor.
Okay. Dina?
I had the opportunity to play in the Maryland Smith LPGA charity golf event on Monday out in Goodyear. And Marilyn Smith is one of the 13 women that started the LPGA back in 1948. So she was actually there, and one of her cohorts, who's 82, played all 18 holes. And it was a lovely event that the goal was to raise $25,000 for scholarships for women's golf. So very cool, nice to meet, gosh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other women golfers. And we got second place. So I just had to throw that out there.
All right. Last night, I sat in for the mayor at the Maricopa Association of Government Regional Council and just want to report that our acceleration of the 802 was approved unanimously. So that will proceed. Very interesting dealing with mayors and representatives from all across the valley. It has some interesting discussion, to say the least. With that, do we have any more reports? Then Mr. Brady, meetings.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Excuse me. Just a reminder, this Saturday, September 25th, we'll be having District 4 Pancake Breakfast at Station 201. So invite everyone there from 8 to 10. Also, this Saturday, we'll be having our recycling event at the East Mesa Service Center from 8 to noon. So that includes the appliances, computers, and electronics. So we do that ahead of time. So. This is just appliances this time. I think the other event, the largest of the following weekend, correct?
Yeah.
Next week, Council, and really for the community next week, will be some significant announcements will be made. Monday specifically, and hopefully this is on the Council's calendar, a major national announcement will be made that Mesa will be part of. That'll be Monday at 11 a.m. It'll be at the Piper Theater. We invite everyone to be there. This will be a special announcement regarding a national competition that Mesa was participating in relating to education and economic development. So we're very excited about that announcement that will take place on Monday, the 27th. Also, next week we'll be having the opening of the ribbon cutting for Fire Station at the Mesa Gateway Airport at Fire Station 215. That'll be at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. We also have a council meeting on Monday the 27th. Thank you very much.
And just on the pancake breakfast, just want to throw out there that we have a number of downtown businesses who have donated some raffle prizes.
Oh, so very nice.
A little more incentive to come out, not just eat breakfast, but and visit with department people, but also some raffle items.
Excellent.
All right. Do we have any items from citizen present?
No speakers.
All right. Councilmember Summers, move to adjourn. Second, Councilmember Fender. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.